Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage. Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage. Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
There are cases that leave you wondering if anyone's really in control. Law enforcement, the courts, or just chaos. The death of 15-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez feels kind of like one of those cases. A teenage girl gone missing multiple times, found months later. Not in a field, not in a lake, but in the front trunk of a Tesla linked to the musician known as David. What followed wasn't clarity. It was more confusion. A search warrant to the Hollywood Hills home tied to him. A landlord claiming critical evidence was left behind. A private investigator stepping in saying he found sadistic plans detailing what was to be done with Celeste. Yeah, there's a lot of questions going on in this case. Former FBI Special Agent Jennifer Coffendaffer joining us to help us break this all down over the weekend. I know you were breaking it down over on your channel, Break the Case. I watched some of that. Then I made a McDonald's Happy Meal themed piece with Sora that involved D4VD, which was, you know, it was horrible. It's a horrible case, but there's so many new things that we're learning in this case that I think are making a lot of us question what is going on in this investigation. What were some of the things you have gleaned off of the private investigator now speaking out loud and talking about what he's finding?
Well, you know, Tony, it's becoming literally, as you said, as clear as mud at this point, because there's so much that we have facts. Then we have innuendo, and then we have new statements from the PI. So if I could, and I actually jotted a few of these down just to give everybody a refresher of our facts.
Yeah.
The facts are April of 2024, she was reported missing. September 2024, she was reported as being back home because she's on video. So it wasn't reported by her family. Nobody told law enforcement, but we know she back home because we've all seen the video.
Yeah.
According to records, law enforcement records regarding the missing case in that jurisdiction, there were three actual missing episodes reported. Okay. So that catches us up on the missing piece. Mm-hmm. There was a parking violation of D4VD's Tesla on August 27th, 2025. There was another parking violation on 9/3/2025. On September 5th, 2025, his vehicle was towed. And on September 8th, just one day after her 15th birthday, so she only lived 14 years, her body was found in the front trunk. Right after the very first reporting, and this was from KTLA-TV, and I always look at the local reporting. They are always on it before it ever becomes a national story. Nobody even knows whether it's going to become a national story. It started out with a body in this trunk. And then all of a sudden, it was a body in D4VD's trunk. And then all of a sudden, it was Celeste, right? This was stepping stones. Mm-hmm. But this was from the very first report. And they reported a dismembered body in the front trunk of the Tesla. This was when they were trying to help in LA get information related to who this could be in this trunk. So they gave a big description: 5'1", wavy black hair, tube top, black leggings, yellow bracelet, stud earrings, 71 pounds, and a finger on her right index finger, SHHH... So that was the description given to the public when this first broke. At that point, of course, an affirmative by that shush, she was identified by her mother as Celeste Rivas Hernandez. So I think it's important to get down those dates, those, you know, that information, because that's facts that's irrefutable in terms of what was reported and particular dates of citations and towings and things.
I want to talk about right at the beginning here with the KTLA reporting and the dismembered body. I'm not trying to be gross or to get gory on this, but it is a key part of this story. That seems to be the only place we've seen the reporting of dismemberment. We've hearing decompose. That's been that part is in the official report, but the dismembered part, is that anywhere in any official reporting, or is that from the KTLA reporting? But I don't see the connection of where KTLA got that from any sort of official source other than maybe some sort of inside source that they have.
What they wrote, and I'm just going to quote this.
Yeah,
they said head and torso. By the way, in that
very specific,
specific. They didn't say limbs. They didn't say finger. We know there had to be a finger. So there's actually a lot of question as to whether the fingers were in the frunk or somewhere else. But according to this initial reporting, which again is what I always start with, they wrote head and torso, quote, according to LAPD.
And then, but you also just described a lot of detail about the body and the weight and all of this. That's what makes me, it's like, okay, if this is is that like weight as in whole of what they found? And the fact that she was wearing a tube top and that sort of stuff as well also strikes me as odd. If the body is dismembered, they keep the clothes on the person. I would almost, I don't know, I've never dismembered a body.
Oh, yeah, but I was going to say, what's your method?
Is that common, Jen, that they're still wearing their clothes when they're dismembered? I don't know the answer to that.
I do. And yes.
Okay.
You know, they don't go through the trouble necessarily of making the body nude. Remember, for the most part, the reason people dismember is to hide or conceal a dead body.
Okay.
Or to conceal what happened. In other words, some people dismember and throw a leg over here and a body part over here. So that it's harder to put together what happened, who did it, where the crime really happened. But it's clear to me that her limbs had to have been in there because, as you said, there's a clothing description and we have the shh tattoo.
So intact to a certain extent. We don't know exact, but the word dismembered is in there, which could mean a part. I mean, that could, I don't know. We just don't know the extent to which, so it's hard to just speculate. With that being said, so we know that. We also have learned new things with this private investigator and the claims that he is making. We've established now what we know officially from the LAPD, but what about these new claims that have come out over the weekend with the private investigator? What have we been learning there?
And can I interject something really quick?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine, hon. My biggest question is, who authorizes a PI to go into a crime scene?
The owner of the house hired the PI.
Okay, that's the part I was missing, because I was trying to figure out why this person was allowed in and allowed to do as much as they could do, as much as they got out of the story. Who allowed this? And what does the LAPD think about that?
Well, it's a great question, Stacey. For just by way of background, he was hired, as Tony said, by the owner of the mansion. Okay. Now, the owner of the mansion says that he rented this to the manager of D4BD, and that, according to the PI, he didn't even have any idea that D4BD was staying there or who was staying there for that matter. And that happens often, right? You lease the house to somebody, you don't know exactly who's going in and out. You don't monitor that information, and that was made very clear. But to go over the PI's information, and I'm going to go over, it's very, very specific. So as an example, the PI says that on 7/29, that is when the vehicle was abandoned, the Tesla where the body was, and that nobody entered it that he knows of. In other words, the body would have been in there. There was no sign that the body was put in there after. I think that is a critical point, that 7/29, now we have sort of a starting point of when it was parked. He says he knows who parked it because the person who parked it wore very distinctive clothing. And he knows that they were in the mansion because he has photos of the same person wearing these distinctive clothing in the mansion 12 hours prior. He never says on Ashley Bamfield or with Jesse Weber who the person is, even though he says he knows who it is. He never says that, and he says he doesn't want to get in trouble with LAPD. But then a close associate of his on social media makes a comment that it could be, or that they believe it's this person named Neo, who is a close associate, a former close associate of D4VD. They actually specifically said that this is based on information from the PI in conjunction with the fact that this person erased their social media, in conjunction with the fact that D4VD and Neo are no longer closely connected, it would seem, for sure, on social media and publicly, obviously, since D4BD hasn't been in the public. And so when you put all of that together, social media is speculating this. And that's where we get into Tony. Yeah. It's a big leap, but I think maybe that gap can be filled in by the fact, if it is a fact, that that PI told his associate about this. It's a big secret to keep.
PI is saying that the person that was driving the car, this is according to the PI, was, because there's an artist named Neo. I'm sure it's not that person, but is Neo, how do you spell this?
Neo.
Neo, okay.
That's different than the other Neo.
Okay.
And I'm sure the other Neo is not enjoying this story at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to be clear, PI doesn't say this is Neo. Associates of the PI are saying it's Neo, and that they put this all together based on statements by the PI in conjunction with social media activity. And there you go.
That's the nexus of this. And this is where the game of telephone continues associates of. So I mean, obviously all this unconfirmed and not in no way saying that this person did anything. I mean, we don't even know if this person knew what was in the trunk, for that matter. That would be, that's still up for speculation. What do we know about what was found in this house that D4DV or that David was renting, that the private investigator is now working for the owner of that home, who said, I want to hire somebody to look into this further?
Well, and it made some sense to me that an owner of a mansion in this situation would want to have somebody look into things. Look, they want to make sure that they are not going to have any culpability, civilly or otherwise, and they weren't getting any answers. The other thing that was interesting, at least according to the PI, I am prefacing all of this because we're playing telephone now.
Yes.
These are words that specifically he said on national television. Mm-hmm. He said that things were left behind by LAPD and that they did not collect, that he felt, meaning the PI felt, were evidentiary, that were left behind by the LAPD. He describes electronics, like a DVD or some other electronic.
Yeah, a DVR, I believe, was listed.
Sorry, DVR.
Yep.
And then also he describes information that he came to know, as you had in your lead up to this conversation, specifically scary, statistic, I'm quoting the PI, mind-blowing and twisted. So basically, this would have been information, obviously, that was left behind that then he found the PI. And he says within, you know, short order, he, the landlord, whoever, they turned this all over to LAPD. Two huge points on this.
Yeah. Why?
It's ruined. It's ruined now.
Yeah. It's very much so. Chain of custody.
It's gone. But,
not only the tree, but it's just... Also, they could say, well, they searched there and it wasn't there. And then somebody planted it there. And it's completely bastardized that evidence. And second of all, now to me, it's called, not that it shouldn't be, but really public scrutiny and scrutiny overall on the LAPD's job on this.
Yes.
But now the prosecutor is going to be hesitant and they know they're going to have to face this in a court of law. God forbid they get somebody as good as Alan Jackson to make hay of all this. I mean, this is something you actually should make hay of.
Yes.
And if you get somebody, a good defense attorney, they are going to blow this up. So it's very interesting, because my question is, and then we should get, I know, back to your question and or answer to your question, but what is the motivation of this PI to come forward? I totally understand the motivation to get involved in this case. He wants to make some big bucks from the mansion owner. He wants to get involved. But that's the whole purpose for a name to be P for private investigator.
Sure.
You're supposed to keep everything private and try to be solving the case instead of blast it all over the media as to your findings. I find that very problematic because of the harm it's causing the investigation.
Or is he blasting this because he sees massive screw-ups already? And it's like, well, if you all are going to not do this to the up-and-up abilities of where you should be, I guess we're going to have to expose you. Because if it doesn't get exposed early on, then it can be lied about later. And it can be, well, we did find that first. Like, there's a lot of, I mean, I kind of get the, I mean, yes, private should be private, but when people aren't doing their jobs, and I'm wondering if this is he's outraged that these obvious large pieces were ignored or not found, and is, you know, taking them to task and basically holding truth to power on something like this.
Perhaps, you know, I don't know necessarily his motivation.
Sure.
But I can say this, Tony, to me, that again, is this the right time for that?
Is it? I mean, it's exactly. I mean, is that going to help the investigation? No. Will it make it, will it be, is it part of holding it accountable? Yes. But is that the right time to do it? I don't know the answer to that. How on earth do you think it is that the LAPD went into this house? We heard reports a couple weeks ago when they were in there that they were like scouring drains. So I'm thinking, okay, they're doing a thorough search of this. And we just kind of got to wait and see what happens, because investigations do take time and they're going to be quiet while they're making their investigation. But then you hear a report like this. And again, this is just from the PI that's making these claims that there's these disturbing, and I'm paraphrasing, letters or notes that were found that talk about the Celeste problem or something of that nature. And even more dark things, it sounds like, is what he's been alluding to. In writing. How do you miss this?
Yeah.
No, you're exactly right. And when you look at it, first of all, that search warrant was served on September 18th, just to get our dates lined up with when her body was found. And then pretty shortly thereafter, this search warrant happens. And yes, according to reports, again, from a lot of the local media, there were drains searched and, you know, which makes sense because they're looking for blood, hair, anything that could be trapped in that drain. So it looks like it's thorough. But the bottom line is, when you do these investigations, you really want an evidence response team that's fully trained on how to collect evidence. They start from sealing, literally making sure nothing is loose up in that ceiling, going all the way down to the floor, making sure no floorboards, no stains when you lift the carpet, that there's nothing stained there, that there's no evidence in all four corners of just a quadrant that each room should be divided up into. And this makes it clear to me that either they didn't divide it up, or the people they had conducting the search really weren't clear on what to search for. Let's be clear that in these search warrants, while they outline what you can search for, it basically, if they put a piece of paper, you can look for in places small enough to contain a piece of paper. So there's no excuse that says, oh, it wasn't on the list. No. That's not how it works. That gives you the legal authority to look in places where this could be found. And this clearly, if it was there then, would have been evidentiary by his description.
Yeah, I mean, these just seem like such, I mean, I'd be curious as to where he found these pieces of evidence that he's talking about. Like, where were these notes? Why was that? And that also strikes me as a little bit odd, too, quite honestly, of anybody of that age writing anything down.
Right.
And putting it on a piece of paper. Granted, we did talk about some digital, maybe it was more digital, because he did talk about it getting the DVR out of there, or some hard drives, things of that nature. Maybe this was captured digitally. Maybe I'm just, you know, running to a conclusion there too fast. But to find this information, and then it's handed over to the LAPD. Great. It doesn't sound like, from the interviews that I watched with Ashley or with Jesse, was that he's trying to work against the LAPD in any way, shape, or form. He seems to be finding stuff and turning it over. But again, you have a private investigator doing that versus the actual LAPD, who is investigating this case as the lead right now. What does that do to the evidence? I mean, what does that do to the investigation when things like this are brought in that sort of a way?
Well, 2 points here. First of all, if this would have been what I consider a properly trained private investigator, and I always encourage people, if you need a PI, please get somebody that has a law enforcement background, particularly in the area of the case that you're looking at, whether that's a homicide, whether it's a theft, whether it's, you know, a white collar case. Get a law enforcement person that has 20 years of experience making mistakes, you know, working these kinds of cases, knowing the inroads, also having great relationships, typically with people on the force that are currently on the force, because they've worked with them for years, right? And this is the critical error. When you go into there, I wonder if he was even gloved. I'm sure he wasn't. But then you say, whoa, there's this DVR or DVD, whatever it was that was there. There's paperwork. Okay, first call. I'm at D4VD's house. I'm securing everything. Nobody else is going back in. I need you to get over here and take a look. I think you all might have missed something. That is the proper protocol, not gathering it all up and, you know, running it down to the PD. I'm just flabbergasted as to how it was answered. And again, my point here is to not go after the PI. The point is to be clear what these mistakes mean to the investigation.
And John, to that point, and I'm not going to ask you to speak for police organizations across the nation, but how do they view a private investigator being called in? How do they view them on a professional level? What's your take on that?
Well, I can tell you, for the most part, they can't stand it. And you might say, well, the reason they don't like it, and again, I'm just speaking from my personal experience in law enforcement for 20 years. The reason isn't because you're worried about people, you know, second guessing your work or finding your mistakes. That has nothing to do with it. What you're really worried about is tainting witnesses, getting statements that then contradict a statement that was previously gave evidence, you know, as in this is a perfect example of evidence. When was that evidence in there? Was it put in there after the search warrant? Was it put in there, you know, before the search warrant? where exactly was it found. Now it's up to a PI to tell us where it was found.
Yeah.
So typically, no, because they're worried about the investigation being hindered. And that's why there's laws against it, too.
But this wasn't an active crime scene. He didn't break any laws going in there to do this.
100%. He had the legal authority to be there. Yeah. 100%, Tony. But I'm saying at the point that he realizes there might be evidence there, that's when he needs to shut it down and call LAPD.
Well, that's what I'm wondering about. I mean, I'm assuming the guy probably went in there thinking, you know, the evidence, the LAPD has already been in here. So they've already taken everything that they're going to think is evidence. And if he's finding more stuff that they didn't take, then he's probably going, they did not do a thorough investigation into this. So, I mean, more information is good, but it also makes me wonder, I'm assuming, you know, if they investigated the house, they probably took pictures. I mean, I'm talking about the LAPD. So I'm curious if on the timeline of this, if some of this information, maybe some of these letters, maybe, I don't know, could they have come after the fact, after the LAPD went in there and investigated? I don't believe that makes a whole lot of sense with the timeline. I think the owner could probably clear that up in terms of the comings and goings of the house with the security system and such. But I guess that does open up the question of, was somebody from his crew in there and they, for whatever reason, left these notes behind? I don't know. I mean, it begs another question and another, you know, bump in this timeline that we don't really have the true answer to.
Well, and Tony, what I would be arguing if I were the defense, I would say, those notes, that's a song. It's a song.
He was working. That. Yep.
Yeah.
There's no way this has to do with Celeste. You know, obviously he was writing other songs about Celeste. Mm. This is just a follow-up song about how we're going to dispose of Celeste in a sadistic, mind-blowing manner.
When you're having people try to cover up something horrible, and I'm trying to look at it from the aspect of, did she die by some sort of accident, by her own hand, by something, and now this group of people who are not good at problem solving are going to have to try and figure out a way to get rid of this body? I mean, disposing of a body in general is a pretty dark, sadistic type thing to have to do if you're doing it and you're not a funeral homeowner.
Right.
It's not like normally a thing anyone is doing on their own. But then to have to contemplate all the ideas and all the ways to get rid of a body, I'd be curious to know what he's talking about in the dark, sadistic sort of realm that he's referring to. Is it dark and sadistic because of the act of what's going on here? Or is it more dark and sadistic because it's pretty gross what you have to do to get rid of a body?
Well, Tony, to your point, just say, and another point that the PI made that I think is very relevant. He said he has all these pictures. I can't remember the number, but it was a lot of pictures of her. And in those pictures, they stopped on January 2nd in the morning. I believe he said that's the last known picture, at least from his vantage, that there is of Celeste. Again, what are we looking at? New Year's Eve. New Year's Eve is a time of partying. It's a time of rebirth. It's a time of people changing things. It's a exclamation point time in a lot of people's lives. It's a time of suicide, all those things. It's a peak run time for law enforcement, right?
Yeah.
And so now you're at the morning of the 2nd, which I just found very interesting. If it's true, that's the last proof of life for her. And then you put that in conjunction with these sadistic writings. Look, if she was at a party and OD'd, I would just say it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that everybody would just panic and say, all right, we need to get rid of the body. I mean, typically you would have people call if it was more of a private situation, which D4VD was very private. He says his whole life was social media. You know, he didn't interact a lot other than at concerts and with his entourage. So if it happened in a small group, still, what makes you just panic and say, listen, we're not just going to call this in. It's obviously via toxology that she, it's going to be obvious, right, how she died. So that's why I think it's something much more nefarious here.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu. At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Cozy traditions feel good, especially this time of year. And that includes changing up your makeup look for fall. From lashes for days with the Viral Liquid Lash Extension Mascara to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener. Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Whether you want a simple just gotta get out the door routine or fall glam that wows from the office to all your favorite fall festivities, you'll always look and feel radiant with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. And for every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to help communities thrive. So every time you use your favorite Thrive Cosmetics product, you're helping communities you care about, too. Complete your fall look. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CauseMetics.com/cozy.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting, confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. With the new Ace line, looking effortlessly sophisticated this fall is easy and comfortable. Stock up on crazy cozy sweatpants, shorts, and sweatshirts that elevate your style. They even have blazers, if you're lucky enough to grab one while they're in stock. Mack Weldon balances classic pieces with updated details to keep you looking sharp. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made with the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.